Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we are coming from Independence, and we have on the Tros, Marge and Dick, with us today. And for those of you who do not know, the two of them were instrumental in the conversation of ordaining women before women were ordained, as well as a lot of other key experiences of the church during the 70s and 80s and even before and since then. So we're going to sit back and let them talk. And I'm thrilled about this, absolutely thrilled. So thank you guys for coming.
Great. It's wonderful to be here and to have the opportunity to share with you and tell our story.
I'm very glad to be here as well.
Thanks. And I should mention that we're recording from the temple in Independence, which is kind of special. So, okay, well, let's, I guess, give our listeners a little bit of background information. So you two are a married couple. So I guess we'll start with whoever wants to go and maybe give us a brief overview of how you met or,
We met at Graceland College. Dick was a year ahead of me, and you were majoring in
agriculture.
Okay.
But changed your
But
major.
I changed my major to chemistry and eventually went to medical school.
Yeah. And I had come to Graceland majoring in math and physical science with the anticipation that I would go into math. I had been told that as a female, I would only be able to teach in chemistry or, you know, if I went into science, that there was no other role for women in science was basically what I was told. And yet math and computers were a brand new field back in the 1950s. And so that was a field that was going to welcome me with open arms. So that was my major when I went to Graceland. I ended up being the only female in a lot of my classes. And it was interesting, Graceland at that time, this was 1953 to 55, considered that they needed to take care of their women students. They were sort of parents and loco, which meant that the fellas had the roam of the campus, had no restrictions. Women had to be in the dormitory by 9:30 and had to have lights out at 10:30.
Oh, wow.
And the fellas could therefore get together and study, do their homework together, and so forth. I was on my own because by 9:30 I was locked in the dorm. If I didn't have the calculus done and 10:30 came, I was supposed to have lights out. Well, I would stay up nights and put a blanket at the door and do my homework, and the night watchman would turn my name in, seeing my light through the door. And so the result was I would get campused on the weekends.
Which meant she couldn't go out with me or any other guy at the time.
Oh, man.
I could only go to the library. And that was my first experience of discrimination. I didn't think of women as a class at the time. I simply thought, I want to get my homework done. I'm here trying to fulfill my stewardship, and they're putting barriers in my way.
Yeah.
And so I went to the dean and negotiated a study hall in our dormitory where we could go after lights out and study. And they said they would try it for finals week that first semester, and we didn't abuse it. And so a study hall then was established. And I guess that was my first feminist act.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it, and I didn't label it that at the time. But
wow.
Then we got married.
We men were just very unconscious that that kind of problem was going on, except when they couldn't go out with us.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, me trying to fulfill my stewardship, as I say, and prepare myself for my career, they were putting barriers in my way.
Yeah, so it's not like it started as an act of rebellion or anything.
No.
It was simply that you were trying to get your work done.
And then we got married. And he was in medical school. I had a wonderful job as a programmer and systems analyst at System Development Corporation. And so I wanted to go on and do graduate work at UCLA. And they said, well, that will be $500 out of state tuition. And I said, but I'm a fifth generation Californian. I'm the only one employed. And they said, well, when you married, you lost your citizenship in the state of California.
Oh.
In the eyes of the law, you are not a person. You are his property.
She was my property.
Wow.
And I was born and raised in Idaho on a ranch 10 miles from the nearest town, 10 miles from the nearest other RLDS member. And so we did have some home teaching about the RLDS church, and I was baptized at age 8. We drove 200 miles to Spokane, Washington, so that my older brother, my father, and I could be baptized all at the same time. I actually knew virtually nothing about the church at that time, and our family attended the Methodist church near our ranch. And our Methodist minister, who was a very good friend of the family, knew of our church membership and recommended that I go to Graceland College and learn about my church. And so at Graceland was where I fortunately met Marge.
But to move on with the out-of-state tuition, again, there was no way to fight that in those days. I just simply was defined as a non-person. Again, I didn't put that together.
Yeah.
A little dense, I guess. Anyhow, he graduated and we went through, we lived in Boston, we lived in Kansas when he got drafted, and various places, always active in the church, basically doing things like leading junior church. And there was no restriction there. And the subject of priesthood, I can remember, came up at a women's department study class one time. And it was just didn't seem that important. Women had power in the church as far as they had their own budget in the women's department. They would do fundraising. They would determine how the money was spent, whether it went toward the organ or toward redoing the kitchen or Sunday schools. And we did vacation Bible school. We did all of those kinds of things. We didn't function in any of the ordinances. But it was not a big issue in our discussions in the 1950s that I can remember. I became women's leader of our local congregation here in Independence in 1966. Actually, in 66, I was assistant women's leader. I was pregnant with our third child. After she had been born, within a month or so, the leader moved away, and they asked if I would become women's leader then. So when I had a two-month-old and a one-and-a-half-year-old and a four-year-old, I became the congregational women's leader.
Wow.
But we got all kinds of things done. Everybody said we didn't have an excuse to give you that we couldn't help out compared to what you were dealing with. So I got lots of support and got lots of things done. So I became stake women's leader. And then we heard in the late 60s, very early 70, that the decision had been made at the World Church that they were no longer going to have a general department of women. They, in a study that had been done, there was some feeling that there were almost like two kinds of members in the church. There were women and there were members. The women were part of the women's department, and there was a line relationship there, and there was the money and all of that kind of thing, and they were kind of able to operate fairly autonomously. And then there was members. So it was determined that it was going to be more appropriate to have all members of the church functioning together under the same leadership. So I had heard rumors that they were doing away with it, but I said, as long as I'm stake women's leader, we'll continue with women's activities and so forth. Well, I was invited to come in for an interview. Jeff Spencer invited me to come and to speak with Morris Draper. Jeff was the commissioner of pastoral services, I think, which included the women. And Morris Draper was a member of the First Presidency.
Okay.
And so they...
W. Wallace Smith was president of our church at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
And so they talked to me about the fact that they were doing away with the women's department as such, but instead what they wanted to hire was a women's ministries consultant. And it was to be a consultant to the church in three different dimensions. One, certainly to the women, and to produce resources and materials and all of that kind of thing. To research about women, to find out their needs and their resources of things they could offer. To be with membership, a consultant, and to help them understand concepts of women's ministries and to receive those ministries. And to be a consultant to administrators at all levels of the church.
Wow.
And to help them understand how decisions that were being made were impacting the lives of women.
That's pretty radical.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. But there were some various interpretations of what that move meant.
Okay.
Because up until then, the women's department had functioned pretty much on its own, and it had its own budget. It produced its own resources, and the director of women had direct relationship in the various jurisdictions of the church at that time. And then some people analyzed this as saying, well, we think that the church leaders should bring the women under their line control. And that would include both their activities, their resources, and their budget. And so there were differing interpretations of the reasons for these changes.
It wasn't a convenient time in my life it wasn't how I had my life planned. Very definitely, as far as working full-time in that kind of thing. I had thought that I would probably end up teaching math once the kids were all in school. But as they described this time of change in the life of the church, it felt like a calling. I knew there would never be another time like this, another opportunity like this. And I was really feeling directed toward that. We went to consult with his parents before we gave them an answer. And his dad said, well, we wondered when you were going to come talk to us, because as soon as we heard that Catherine Westwood was leaving the director of women position, we knew, he said, I was as sure of it as a calling as I was of my son's, the offices of priesthood. And so they had even discussed that for childcare on a routine basis during the week, we needed to make other arrangements. But if I had to travel for the church, they would actually move into the house and take care of the kids so that I would be free to go as I needed to go. on opportunity. So,
but even though this was regarded by my folks and Marge as a calling, there was really virtually no discussion about ordination of women at that time. This was a calling for women to more fully participate in what you would call much more traditional roles for women, and virtually no discussion of ordination.
But the use of the word ministry in association with women was threatening to a lot of people. Mm. In fact, I went to one place in the field to bring ministry, and the man who introduced me said, "And we will now listen to the World Church Women's Mystery Consultant."
Oh.
He couldn't even say that word ministry in relation to women. It was such a threat.
Wow.
Well, one of the first things that happened was Jeff Spencer took me over to St. Paul's School of Theology and introduced me to several people there and said to them, "We would like for you to provide for Marge, for Sister Tro, a reading list and to raise her consciousness." And so consciousness raising was a very important dimension of the women's movement in the 1970s. Women would get together and tell their story. And they would explore the images that were happening in their lives. We would do such things when we went to retreats as to have people say, "In whose image are you created? Are you created in God's image or in the image of the media?" And we would take magazines and we would make posters and all of that kind of thing of the messages that we were receiving from society, and then really spend time in reflection to determine whether was this what God was creating to me to be, what God was calling me to be, that kind of thing. And so on the part of some of the leadership in the church, it was very intentional that women would begin to think in different lines. Now, as I say, I needed my consciousness raised. When I interviewed with the personnel department, they flat out said, "Now your salary is not the same as men who are working in similar positions because you're married to a doctor, so you don't need so much money."
Oh.
And so I accepted that. Yeah. I went to work for less pay, not realizing that they were denying us the benefit of being good stewards and to determine how to use our resources. They were already taking from me my offering for the church.
So one of the consultations that our church leaders needed was a consultation about equal pay for women.
Yeah.
So I knew how to do research in the physical sciences because I was trained in that through my academic work, but I didn't really know how to do research in the behavioral sciences. And I wanted to be able to construct surveys and questionnaires and that kind of thing that would be unbiased and that would get at the resources of women and that kind of thing. And so I went over to UMKC and I, in the process, ended up getting a master's degree in social psychology. But one of the classes that I took was sociology of women. And we had to keep a journal. And as I was journaling all these experiences, I began to see things that had happened not just to me as an individual, but they were happening to women as a class. And I was part of the class of women that was being discriminated against.
Wow.
And so that then got shared with the Women's Ministries Commission.
And it was shared with, few men like me.
I'm sure.
Actually, there was a spontaneous group that sprung up that had no official status in the church. It was just a group of women. It was called AWARE, and they were feminist women in the church in the 1970s. And we would gather, potluck suppers, what have you. We would study. We had retreats on occasion, and that kind of thing. Well, our husbands needed their consciousness raising also, so.
Right. So we formed a men's group that was almost identical in membership as the husbands of these talented women. And the
but
fact
there were
that,
some differences.
That we supported them. Incidentally, our men's aware group, which is what we finally called it, we discussed taking a special name for our group, Macho. Which would have meant men affirming creative human opportunities. But we thought Macho would take too much explanation. And so we just continued to call ourselves the Men's Aware Group.
Okay.
And so we did discuss largely the issues of equality and, of course, all of the issues that men talk about with regard to church administration.
The women's group gleefully gave them reading lists of books that we wanted them to read.
Our group included Dick Howard and Grant McMurray, who became one of the presidents of the church.
Yeah.
I think Peter Judd was in it.
And Peter Judd, who became a member of our first presidency, was a member of that group.
So aware, you know, became a good sounding board and a good outside the officialdom support. But then I also had a wonderful women's ministries commission that worked with us. And so we did a number of things. We had retreats for women and administrators. One of them, I can remember, Frank Kelly was there and responded at one point. We all had name badges, but the members of the Women's Commission had ribbons on theirs. And the ribbons were to designate us so that if anybody had questions, they could come to us for information or what have you. But Frank didn't interpret it that way. He looked, he saw it, and he thought, there they are. And they think they know what I need as an administrator. And so they're here telling me all these things and providing this ministry for me. And then he went, oh, maybe that's what I'm supposed to learn. Because I always think that I'm doing wonderful ministry for them. But I haven't asked any of them. I don't have any women counselors or any. I just
feedback or
all the men plan the stuff, assuming that we are bringing, you know, and that hadn't been our intent, but he was very perceptive to see that kind of thing. So as time developed, we realized that we had to do a whole lot. We had a whole lot of tasks that we had to do. Our congregational structures had to be open to the participation of all according to their gifts. There was nothing that said women couldn't be on committees. There was nothing that said women shouldn't be offering prayers and ministry and worship. Certainly, yes, the ordinances did have to have ordination. But there's so much, so many gifts that women have to offer in worship and in education and in finance and in every dimension of congregational life. And that needs to be seen as ministry. We really need a redefinition of ministry. And so the Women's Commission worked really, really hard. And one of the definition that we basically came up with was perceiving a need and then responding to that need in such a way that God's purposes are fulfilled. And when you define ministry that way, your day-to-day job, your life in the home, your life in the neighborhood, your life within the walls of the church, all of those things can be ministry if you perceive it that way and if you approach it that way. If you approach that job in the PTA as, through this, I am trying to give ministry, and you pray about it and you work toward it, it becomes ministry.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to definitely broaden the definition of what we meant by ministry, and that was not limited to priesthood. So we designed congregational structures. We put out a new handbook for women's ministries. That was 1974, and that had five models of organization in it and a worksheet designed to help you work through and figure out for our particular group what model is going to work best.
Okay.
And so we had workshops around how to do that. And that's when we first came up with the commission structure so that in congregational life, there was a worship commission or planning group, a pastoral care, an education, a stewardship, and women began to serve in all those different areas.
But at this point, there still was virtually no discussion of women's ordination. They were developing the idea of ministry of the member and women as full members, but it was just rarely ever discussed until what world conference was it when Buddy Edwards presented a resolution suggesting that the First Presidency investigate or have a committee investigate the possibility of ordination of women. He was shouted down, and there was objection to consideration. And at that conference, it was just immediately quelled, but the question had been brought out into the open.
Yeah.
And so it was considered from then on.
Yeah. That was 1970, I think, when that happened. And so the First Presidency, you know, it did not pass or anything, but First Presidency did appoint a committee on roles for women that functioned. Paul Booth chaired that committee.
He was one of our apostles.
Okay.
And I was on that committee. And that came back to the 1974 World Conference, it was 72 conference on recommendations on roles for women. And it, really opened up the way for women to serve on boards and committees and all of that kind of thing. And then there was a resolution that came before the World Conference saying that all those in administrative positions be requested to appoint, nominate, and hire more women to those positions which did not scripturally require priesthood. So again, expanding the participation, but those that did not scripturally require priesthood.
That resolution, someone rose to refer that to the Joint Council, and the Joint Council consists of the First Presidency, the Quorum of 12 Apostles, and the Presiding Bishopric. Well, the sentiment was that I was certain that motion of referral would pass, but I rose to request the floor. President Smith, W. Wallace Smith, said, Dr. Trowe, I hope you realize that you cannot discuss the merits of a motion of referral, but only such things as the time or the body to which referral is made. And I just said, President Smith, I'd like to point out that this motion of referral is to refer the opportunities for women's participation in the church to an all-male body. There was laughter, and the motion of referral was voted down.
Wow.
And then there was a little more discussion, and the resolution passed.
Wow. Wow. I love this church.
Yeah. So it has been an interesting journey. But so the Women's Commission then functioned and gave reports every World Conference, and those reports had numerical counts of how many women were serving on every committee the church had. And, you know, we just continued to raise up the level of participation that women had.
And how were the women in the congregations responding? Because I'm sure it was mixed, right? I mean, were some people eager to serve in greater capacities?
Yeah.
And you probably got pushback from others.
We had some women and men both, yeah, who were very threatened by it, who, you know, saw the apple cart being very much upset. They really, as long as there was not a variety of roles available, a woman could feel very comfortable,
mm-hmm,
you know, I'm okay. I don't have to branch out. I'm okay because I'm doing this.
Yeah.
And so for some women, it was very threatening.
I'm taking care of the children. I'm teaching children's church school class. I'm doing enough.
And supporting my husband. You know, for some women, it was threatening. But for others, it was a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
You know, and women began to receive the ministry of other women.
Mm.
And then men also found that, yes, a woman can listen and hear and be perceptive of needs and things that hasn't necessarily been present in the ministry that I've received before. You know, so there was a lot of that kind of both positive and negative kinds of things that went on. Became aware that language was really important. Mm-hmm. That from early on, to try to talk about, you know, that male pronoun he means everybody sometimes, doesn't other times. Women always had to go through in singing hymns, in reading scriptures, in everything. The gymnastics.
Yeah.
I was at one women's retreat, and for the retreat, if we would have a prayer meeting at the end of retreat or a testimony service or a commitment service, the men always had to come in for that, so we would have the priesthood authority for that. And so I was in one place where the men had planned that closing service, and they had chosen as their hymns, "Let us, brothers, let us gladly, faith of our fathers, God send us men."
Oh, no.
I mean, the list went on and on. And finally, one of the men that was presiding said, "This is really getting ridiculous, isn't it? Let's change this one to 'Let us, sisters, let us gladly.'"
Yeah.
And so a committee on inclusive language was formed. And so they developed a policy of inclusive language, which was adopted by the First Presidency and then became the official policy of Herald House. And so all of our publications were reviewed. And so hymns began to even be altered. And again, for some people, that was very threatening.
Yeah.
They thought, you know, it just was...
You can speak of all men and mean men and women. Many.
And they just didn't like us bothering with that kind of tradition.
Yeah.
And then to speak of God in anything other than male imagery was very threatening to some people. I was teaching in Australia, and there was a dear woman, eighth grade education. She was the camp cook, and her pattern was to pray in the morning, looking on this wonderful grotto while she was cleaning the vegetables for the day. And the night before in class, we had talked about God and images. And she was not sure what to do with that, but she came back the next night and she said, "I have just had the most wonderful worship experience of my whole life." She said, "I started my prayer this morning," and she said, "I never got past what to call God." She said, "For 45 minutes, I named God in every dimension and aspect I could think of. And the 45 minutes had gone, and I hadn't even run out of names for God." And she said, "It was the most powerful thing to think of God beyond how I had been frozen in time."
How
so
beautiful.
there were steps along the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, the consciousness raising, the language, the definition of ministry, all of these were foundations that were really important. And it was funny to me to go back, not funny, it was kind of shaking, to look, for instance, at the Doctrine and Covenants. Section 24 of our Doctrine and Covenants is directed toward Emma.
Mm-hmm.
And I had always known that it said she was to be a helpmeet to her husband, and she was to prepare a hymnal. Well, it also says, and she is to be ordained under his hand to expound the scriptures and exhort the church.
Yeah.
Well,
how did we miss that?
Sounds like preaching to me.
Yeah.
You know? And that was actually given between the time that she was baptized and confirmed.
Mm.
And so that's kind of maybe a description or a little bit of a glimmer of some of the things that are part of the office and calling of member.
Member. Yeah.
But that was never even mentioned when I took scriptures in college.
Yeah.
Or all the times that I had studied the Doctrine and Covenants, that wasn't even mentioned. Yeah. There were scriptures that were very important to me in the time, the story of Esther.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows but what thou hast come to the kingdom for such time as this. And that's kind of how I experienced my life, was being called to this particular position at this particular time.
Her name, by the way, was held for good and bad by people during this time, because many people applauded and approved and were happy about what the director of women and her commission were doing at the time, and some were threatened by it.
Yeah.
And thought they were pushy. And so there was some resistance, but it was the minority.
Yeah. So was your end goal in your mind ordination, or had you personally thought of that? Or
I knew it would happen sometime.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, that was not my goal as such.
Okay.
I knew it would happen. For me, when ordination happened, it needed to happen with this new understanding.
With the foundation there.
That ministry is a response to a calling and a response to God's leading to empower the people you are ministering with.
Yeah.
You know, to release their gifts and that kind of thing.
I think it was important to expand the opportunities and the understanding of ministry. I know one service I planned, I invited a woman to give the sermon. Well, the pastor, one of our male pastors, questioned that, thinking only priesthood could give sermons.
Mm. And do you remember what year this was or what time?
This was in the 70s, during the time you were commissioner. But I gave him Webster's dictionary definition of sermon, and it was simply a religious discourse.
Oh.
And I said, this woman can give a religious discourse as well as any ordained person. And so, at least at that time, a non-ordained person was accepted as able to give a sermon.
Yeah.
In our congregation, after our pastor became convinced and allowed me to schedule that person to give the sermon. But so I think the expansion of the women's participation and opportunities needed to happen before the additional step of ordination would occur.
Yeah, there definitely were times that the Women's Ministries Commission did discuss ordination.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have one of our summer workshops for the commission. It wasn't for others. It was for the commission and for some key administrators, where we did study priesthood, priesthood structures, and the question relative to women and that kind of thing. So, you know, yes, it was certainly a relevant topic, but it was one that, as I say, definitely needed all of these other foundations to be laid. It was a time in society when the women's liberation movement was mm-hmm. going on. And so liberation became a very scary word to a lot of people. Again, a scripture that was very useful to me at that time is in Galatians 5:13. You've been called unto liberty. Only use not liberty as an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. So during this time in society, there was the National Women's Movement. There was a
Equal Rights Amendment.
There was the Decade for Women declared by the United Nations. There was the National Conference. And
that was called by President Jimmy Carter.
Well, yeah.
Or suggested.
Yeah, and then happened a bit later than that. But at any rate, there was a point where I was running to be a delegate to that conference. And I was talking to people, trying to get them to vote. And when they found out I worked for church, they said, you know, how can you work for church and be a feminist? And so I said, well, I think church and society need to be in dialogue with each other. And I think that there are things that society, you know, the church has not always been faithful. It tries, but the church is made up of humans trying to understand God's will, but lives in the midst of society.
Yeah.
And so part of my calling was to call the church to accountability and to help it to be faithful. And yet I said, you know, so society helped raise our consciousness inside the walls of the church. And yet at the same time I said, but the church has things to say to society too.
Mm.
The model of Christ.
Yeah.
Very helpful article was called Jesus Was a Feminist.
Mm.
That was just an excellent article that talked about his relationship with women. But I also look at the marriage covenant in the church, which says you both mutually agree to be each other's companion, that is, husband and wife, keeping yourselves holy for each other and from all others, so long as you both shall live. But that is a mutual covenant. It is not one dominating the other.
Yeah.
Some churches still use man and wife in their vows.
But that's such a beautiful model of the possibilities of marriage.
That is. It really is.
And so, you know, the church and society are in dialogue. Well, as we progressed through the 1970s and got into the early 80s, it really became obvious that I needed to get out of the way. It became obvious that to me, and probably to others, that everything that I was saying always would be through a filter, that they would interpret what I was saying and that I was pushing for. And it was like I was almost a block, finally, for some people. And so there was a resolution that the women's department was going to be eliminated. And there was a resolution at that time could come over the signature of 25 or more delegates. And so I did not generate the resolution. No one on the commission did. But others became aware that the department was going to be eliminated. And yet conference was not aware that the department was going to be eliminated. The budget had just indicated some adjustments would be made after conference.
Okay.
And so we knew that those adjustments included the elimination of the women's department. And the work wasn't finished.
Yeah.
And so...
So real quick, what year was this?
This would have been 1982.
Okay.
Conference. And so the resolution was written. I submitted my resignation to the presidency to be effective after conference, but I had already turned in my letter of resignation. The resolution came up. The presidency asked me to move it and to request that it be immediately tabled.
Well, the resolution was to retain the Women's Ministries Division, and so her resignation came so it would not be feeling that she was just trying to save her job.
Oh, okay.
That she resigned first and that she wasn't just trying to retain her job because there were disputes about women's roles at that time.
And yet I didn't want it to be convenient for them that, well, I've resigned, so now we'll just do away with it because, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So at any rate, they wanted me to move it and immediately request to be tabled. And I said, I can't do that. But the mover of the resolution does have 5 minutes to speak to it in our structure. And so I said, I think I can say some helpful things and talk about the work that is yet to be done, but I would have to publicly state my resignation so that they would not think I was trying to save my job. Okay. So I did make my resignation on the floor of World Conference.
Wow.
In front of all those people, and then did make my statement, and there was some debate, and the resolution did pass. So the women's department did continue.
Not a department, but
well,
the Office of Women's Ministries.
Women's Ministries. So I did move out of the position.
Okay.
And so that would have been 1982. And so then I went on, got finished my master's, was teaching and so forth, and was involved in the life of my congregation. It was pretty tough being in the congregation because there was a lot of church leadership there. But I said, you know, it's my church. This is where I need to be. And the very next communion Sunday after I had resigned, they asked me to speak at Walnut Gardens and share a bit of my story. And
Walnut Gardens is well known as one of the most liberal congregations of our church.
Okay.
But the one of the hymns was, O Holy Dove of God Descending, and its chorus is, Spirit Now Live in Me.
Mm.
In preparation for that communion service, I had been deeply, deeply hurt, but I decided I want to be a Spirit-filled person. And so I gave myself from World Conference till the first Sunday in May to be angry, hurt, disappointed, what have you.
Yeah.
Did some journaling and all those things. And then gave it up to say, Spirit, now live in me. Well, I was very involved also ecumenically. The church during the 1970s had become a supporting denomination of Church Women United. And so I represented the church on the national board. And that, again, came to an end in 1982 when I left my position. In 1984, they elected me to be the nominating chair nationally for Church Women United. And that put me back on the board. Very supportive group and a very important group in, again, in my faith journey. And a lot of dear, dear friends there. In 1988, I guess I was back on the board as a regional coordinator. And they were going to have a committee meeting of national people from all different denominations. And we were having it in Independence, Missouri, at my house. And they were going to stay in the homes of members of my unit of Church Women United from different dimensions. But they were going to be at my house. And I got a phone call the afternoon before they were coming, and it was my pastor. And I said, oh no, as soon as I heard his voice, I knew he was coming to present a priesthood call to me. And I thought, not now, God, I don't have time. I have bids to make and floors to scrub. And then I thought, well, I can pray, I guess, while while I'm doing those things. And so John came over that night, along with someone else, asked what all was going on because he saw all my preparations there, and said, do you suppose that they would come to church with you on Sunday? Because I would like to present your call to the congregation on Sunday and have you respond, and it would be awesome if they would be there.
Now, they included women from many denominations.
Okay.
On the Church Women
Catholic,
United,
Methodist, Presbyterian,
National Executive
Lutheran,
Committee.
You know, you name it. And they were our national president and our national executive director and,
wow.
you know, all of these people. Well, I went out to the airport to pick them up and they said, you know, we got to talking on the plane and we realized we had never been worshiped in one of your churches. Do you suppose we could adjust our schedule so we could be there on Sunday to worship with you? And so I told them what was happening and, you know, they helped me prepare. And then I also said, and it's Communion Sunday. Now, here's how we understand communion.
We were close communionists at the time.
But I said, but, you know, it means a renewing of our covenant and so forth. And I said, but if you desire to partake, it will not be removed from you. And then I called my pastor and told him what I'd said. And he said, okay, I'll let the priesthood know. And if any of them have troubles with it, I'll say thank you. We'll put you in another part of the congregation or we'll just get somebody else and you can serve next week. And it was such a powerful, powerful experience. And afterwards, my pastor had said, well, I knew in your calling that you were called to ecumenical ministries and, you know, called to witness in this larger community.
But at that communion service, President Wallace B. Smith was there, and President Bud Sheehy, another member of the presidency.
Apostle Joe Sirig.
They were all in the congregation. And one of our female elders gave the communion talk. Very visibly, all of these guest women took the communion.
It was a beautiful experience.
It was a beautiful service.
I was not, you know, among the first women to be ordained. And that was important to me. That would not have been appropriate.
Yeah, okay.
That would not have been.
There had been rumors among some of the membership that women had secretly been ordained.
Oh.
And they named Barbara Howard.
Barbara Higdon.
Barbara Higdon.
There's a lot of Barbara.
And many said Barbara Trow. They mixed up her name. But there were rumors among the people who were upset that there had been secret ordinations.
Yeah.
And there were never any secret ordinations.
There were none. There had been calls for women sitting on the presidency's desk that they hadn't been able to process because they did not have that authority to do so.
So which office were you called to? And at this point, what office were you, Dick?
I was a high priest.
Okay.
And I was called to the office of elder.
Okay.
But as I say, I was not among the first. It was later that I was. And that was important because I did have, you know, standing as a member, and I had, because I was known, I had access. I was able to model the ministry of a member. And so it was important for that dimension. But I knew the time would come. I just didn't know it was going to be the night before I had this gathering at my house. And so, but, you know, what perfect timing God had for that.
What a beautiful ecumenical moment.
And she has since been ordained a high priest as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then later in 1998, I became pastor of a congregation. And shortly after that, I was called to be a high priest.
Okay.
And this is the congregation attended by Wallace B. Smith and by Bud Sheehy.
And so you're still in that congregation now,
yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a functioning congregation.
We now live in a senior retirement center, the Groves. And so on Wednesday nights, we go to services there at the Groves, but we're still very involved in the congregation on Sunday mornings and Vacation Bible School and all those other things. I serve on the worship committee.
Yeah.
Dick's been involved with scouts there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So can I ask a little bit about, the environment on a personal level, just right after the ordination of women, being in independence, the people who were not thrilled about it were probably loved ones and, you know, your friends, maybe even family, congregation members. How was that environment?
I think, you know, people, of course, knew where we stood.
Yeah.
And our family was entirely supportive.
Okay.
And
both sides of our family.
And I need to tell you quickly too, the ecumenical community, when I was serving on that national board, it would be the pattern of the national board to often have, a 24-hour period of fasting and prayer on behalf of something. And you would sign up for a time slot. And, so at that point, President Reagan was going to meet with Gorbachev in Reykjavik,
Iceland.
And so they were going to have a day of, you know, and that was the first day women were to be ordained in our church. And so I said to this leadership group in Church Women United, I cannot fast on that day. I must feast. And so they said, we will feast with you on that day. We will change our day to a different day. And all of the leadership of Church Women United feasted with us on the first day that women were ordained.
Wow. The
and rather World than Conference. Have one person be the first woman to be ordained, the decision was made to have women in our church all over the world be ordained on that same first day.
So no one can claim the title.
So that no one first woman would ever be recognized. The women could realize they were ordained on the first day,
but
there were many ordained on that first day.
So it was a little bit less of a race to ordination.
But here in the community, you know, in our stake, for instance, when we had stake conference, and there were women's names presented. There was a great deal of pain and bitterness by many, many people. And, you know, votes, you finally, normally when we go to a state conference or a mission center conference, you don't have to register and be given a voting card or anything like that. But because there would be people coming in from the outside and attempting to sway the vote one way or another. You know, they had to do that kind of regulation because there were lots of very painful, very bitterful places.
Well, and the first stake conference at which women's names were presented, we actually did have many people come in from surrounding areas and vote against them.
Oh, wow.
And they were voted down in that first conference.
Yeah. And there were
and
people
so
who-
thereafter, we had to have our card indicating we're a member of this area. And then they were passed the next time.
Wow.
So there were some very painful times. But in our you know, with our immediate family and that kind of thing, there was great support.
There was support. Yeah. Wow. Okay. This has been a delight so far. I've just been soaking it all in.
Things have moved rapidly.
I might just make a general statement.
Yeah.
That might be what my closing is, that it's been a great blessing to the church to receive the ministry of its women much more completely than it ever did before.
Yeah.
And some have said that it has also raised all of the ministry that occurs in the church, that women at first, you know, were an oddity, and they knew that they had to prepare and to prepare well, and they took what they did very seriously. And so some of the men who had become a little more casual about their ministry realized they needed to step up and so forth. So, you know, I think ministry in general has been just so enriched and so enhanced.
Yeah. I really didn't realize that ministry had been almost redefined at the start of all of this. That's a new bit of information to me. So do you think the journey is over? I mean, as far as women being included, or are there still things that you wish that you could see on a more broad spectrum? Or,
well, of course, you know, women have had to go through this journey, and now we realize that there are others who are still struggling with the question of ordination, mainly talking about the gay and lesbian community, mm-hmm. and transgendered, et cetera, that there are struggles that they will face as we move ahead. But, you know, God will work how God works.
Yeah.
And I just know that we have been so enriched by receiving the ministry of women in all roles now, whether it's evangelistic ministry, presiding, and yet the other thing that I think is important is that the ministry of member has been elevated.
Yeah.
And I think that is so critical, because not all are called. You know, not everyone's gifts necessarily are in a specific office. But I think it's lifting the ministry of children, the ministry of youth, and the ministry of people who are not members. To me, an important story was the Good Samaritan. That story was told to Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And who was it that was the one that helped? It was a Samaritan. It was a Jew that was in the ditch, and it was a Samaritan that helped.
A non-member.
And so the message, go thou and do likewise, we so often take it as the Samaritan that we're supposed to do likewise. Well, I think Jesus might have been talking to the Jews to say, there's the Jew you identify with. Receive the ministry that other people have to give you.
That's a really good way to look at that story.
Receive that ministry.
Yeah.
Another favorite story of mine is the woman with the issue of blood, who for 12 years had suffered. And finally, what she did was she reached out and touched the hem of Jesus' garment, which was a total no-no.
Mm-hmm.
But she lived as if she was okay. She lived as if it was okay to touch. And Jesus affirmed that. And so, for me, there are a lot of people who didn't seem to visibly be in the same struggle, but they were already living as if. My calling was to work on behalf of a whole class of people. But I had for myself people like Barbara Howard, like members of my Women's Commission, Imogene Goodyear and Madeline Brunson and Barbara Potts and so many others, and Barbara Higdon and you know, becoming president of Graceland, and my mother, who were people who lived as if their gifts and so forth were going to be accepted. There were even some like Helen Pearson who had to go someplace else. She felt called, and there was no place here for her. And so she went to
Disciples of Christ.
Disciples of Christ.
Okay.
Got her degree.
Her seminary.
And she's at Emory University. Her love for the church and her commitment to the church is still there, but her calling, in order to be expressed in its time, had to take her someplace else.
Yeah.
Well, I had some Church Women United people apologize to me for stealing Helen from us. And I said, consider Helen our gift to you. Because Helen had been prepared.
Yeah.
And she is loved, and her ministry is well received in her other church.
And she still functions here as far as serving on boards. She's been on the seminary board and so forth.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
But my calling in the 70s was on behalf of a class.
Yeah.
And
Well, a lot of people owe you a pretty big thanks.
And my calling was to be a good, supportive husband.
Amen. Just, we've been a team.
Well, doing that, you know, in the midst of three little kids, that's rough.
And they're fabulous grown kids now.
That's good to hear.
Yeah. So, yes.
We are a very close family.
Yeah.
Good.
All of our children and grandchildren and we.
So I guess I have to ask you, and maybe this is just my personal curiosity, but was it ever a struggle, or did you ever doubt with having little kids that maybe the time wasn't right or anything like that? Or you just plowed through it and knew this is where God was calling you?
I grew up in a home where my mother was an elementary school teacher.
Okay.
Took six months off to have my brother and 6 months off to have me. So I had never perceived a conflict between having a family and having a career. I went to Graceland for two purposes. One was to find a husband, and one was to prepare myself for my career. And I did a good job of both. And so it was a struggle. I mean, I was not only doing that, but I had an aunt with Alzheimer's, and I was her guardian. And then, you know, parents were aging somewhat, and so.
She gave my parents a lot of care as they aged.
And
especially my father, who outlived my mother by several years.
So, as I say, when the position was offered to me, it wasn't how I'd had my life planned.
Yeah.
And yet, for the summers, what we did was we got Graceland students to come and live in and be nannies, and then they traveled with us and went to reunions and and that kind of thing. And so, you know, and I think all of the caregivers that we had enriched our family.
And I bet that was really neat for your kids to grow up, you know, seeing a mother and a father who were both working in ministerial capacities and being able to go on some of the trips and things like that. That's really cool. Yeah, that's amazing.
So it's a good model.
Definitely. Definitely.
Well, I doubt if you can inject this earlier. As I said, I grew up on a ranch in Idaho and lived 10 miles from the nearest town where there was one other RLDS family. And so we attended the Methodist church, and the Methodist minister recommended that I go to Graceland, which of course changed my life. I learned much more about my church thereafter. After I had gone to Graceland in the agriculture department, probably planning to follow my older brother who was working with the Soil Conservation Service, although I might have gone back to being a farmer and rancher instead. But my English teacher, a wonderful lady named Tess Morgan at Graceland College, decided I was fairly smart and said, "Dick, why don't you be a doctor?" And after she repeated that advice several times, I decided I would think about it. And so I finished my bachelor's degree at Kansas University. And then I became one of two out-of-state students at UCLA Medical School. And that was when Marge and I got married after my first year at medical school, when we knew that she could support me. And so she supported me the next few years while I was in training. And when she registered for those classes and had to pay out-of-state tuition because she had married an out-of-California husband. But here she was a fifth-generation California native. She was the one employed, the one paying taxes, and yet was defined as my property. And so we both became aware at that time, but we were totally ineffective in fighting it. So we paid the out-of-state tuition. And then I did my internship in Boston and then went back and did my residency in internal medicine at Stanford University Hospitals, interrupted by 2 years in the U.S. Army as a battalion surgeon, and got sent away from my family to Germany for a time, and enjoyed my participation, however, in the RLDS church congregation in Berlin, which was a wonderful congregation. And then came back home, and when San Francisco area became a stake, during my residency at Stanford, I was ordained a high priest, so that I could participate in the stake high council. And so, my ministry over the years has been much more as kind of a high priest, ambassador without portfolio. Very few specific jobs, but simply trying to minister as a high priest where I've been.
Yeah.
And in many ways, being a supportive husband in Marge's role was one of the most important things I've done in my life.
That's wonderful.
And enabling our kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's huge. When these paradigms and, you know, start to switch and having it be normal. I know moments after I was ordained, Josh and I served communion together, and it was like, wow, this is, you know, it's going to be normal for my kids. And
yes,
and it is. And it was kind of funny. We, I was able to baptize a woman in Salt Lake, and one of my daughters shouted down the stairs that morning, "Mom, don't forget your dry clothes, because when you get in the font, you're going to get wet." I just thought, how amazing. My little five-year-old, you know, she's already getting it. And it's just
thinking
normal for mom to be in the font. And
great.
So
this will have them growing up knowing it's normal.
Yeah. Yep. It's exciting. And it wouldn't be possible without the journey that the church has taken. So.
And it's, you know, it's been a painful journey for some people in the church. And, you know, it's been painful for us at times.
Yeah.
But people can change.
Not understood.
I was chair of our worship commission for a time, and I would arrange for certain speakers that I thought would do a good job. But I had one gentleman. Well, no, now I need to back up. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm a little Alzheimer's cutting in, you know.
That's okay.
But actually, another gentleman became worship commission chair and invited me to plan a service. And I planned for a woman to give the sermon. And then I went out of town for a couple of weeks, and he told me that he wasn't ready to have a woman give a sermon, and that he hoped I didn't mind. He'd arranged for someone else, and I told him I did mind. And I was supposed to preside over that service, and I said, "I hope you found another presider, because I won't participate in that service."
Wow.
And finally, I convinced him to change back and have the woman preach that I had arranged. And it was a little tense. He didn't attend that day. But would you believe the next year I heard him talking to someone else about their objection to a woman preaching? And he said, "I changed my mind, and so can you."
Oh, wow.
And it was good to see that.
Yeah.
That he just admitted he changed his mind.
Hearts are changing. Yes. It's good. Well, thank you. This was a fascinating conversation. I'm really, really glad that we had it. And
It's been our delight to be able to share with you.
Well, I've been delighted to see your journey and Joshua's journey as you've put it on Facebook.
It's been wild.
Yeah.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.